This is the Saxo Market Call, the daily financial markets podcast, across asset classes and around the world.
Hello and welcome to the Saxo Market Call. It is Tuesday, 21st of March, 2023. Markets putting on a show of calm here. We have a lot of mean reversion after all the choppy trading and the big gap lower after the weekend, which saw another intervention, of course, this time of Credit Suisse. Yields rebounding a bit as well after gapping lower. So market attempting to put on a sense of calm here. If you look at some of the financials, though, there's still, you know, the sector has hit equity-wise, at least, Peter, with quite a bomb here, and it's still been reset lower. It's not rebounding the way we're seeing the mean reversion elsewhere. So it's a really nervous sense of here what's going on. We're awaiting next steps. Of course, the FOMC is going to need to weigh in tomorrow. It's going to really need to change its guidance relative to what we were seeing at the prior Fed meeting to meet the market where it's at. Will it do so? Lots of questions hanging in the air here, and really tough to find some information value, I feel. I don't know what your feeling is in this market.
Yeah, pretty much. So, I mean, I think that the we have had the impact now going on for 11 days, and we've had bond yield coming down pretty hard, and a big reset on U.S. dollar futures, and you know the pricing of Fed funds rates trajectory from here. And I think the way I look at it, a lot of it is due to increased uncertainty and hedging activities, because what happens here has increased the probability of a recession. And even before we got the banking crisis going, we talked about the recession by design, where Powell had this very powerful speech before the banking crisis hit, where he said, we'll push the rates higher and keep them up there for longer. So it just seemed like all paths are leading in this direction. But for now, the market seems calm. I just find it a little bit interesting if you just do the thinking that, okay, so we're back to around 4,000 in the S&P 500. So we have recouped most of the losses that started with this whole debacle. And the yields are lower, but we have had a pretty we've had a big blow to the banking system. Funding costs are higher in the banking system. High yield spreads are moving out, etc. So I think the total cost and the potential second order effects of all of this we haven't seen yet and could still come. So I take a very cautious view still on equities. I think the outcome range here going forward is still extremely high, and there is a lot of uncertainty, not only on the policy side, but especially also on the economic side of things.
Yeah, and one of the news items that may be providing some sense of security here or some sense of hoping that things can return to normalcy was a story Bloomberg ran where it, according to sources, we see the FDIC looking at possibly insuring all deposits in the case of emergency. There's a coalition of banks that is sort of requesting this, and the Treasury would have to look into whether it can even do so in terms of it doesn't have the authority to do so without an act of Congress. Congress probably hopelessly divided in terms of partisan divisions to do something in rapid fashion unless there's a very dire emergency. So that's an interesting story, but it would not solve, Peter, as we look forward to slide three there in your overview of the banks. It would not solve a case in which depositors aren't necessarily concerned about whether they're insured, but they're saying, look, you're not giving me the yield I deserve on my savings account. I'll just go buy a treasury or find some other higher yielding instrument to place my money.
No, exactly. I should have put in a wonderful chart I will have in my equity outlook, if I can say it myself. That really showed the gap, the difference between the average deposit rate on a 3-month time deposit, so not even on demand, a 3-month time deposit in the U.S. I think it's around 61 basis points as of February, and if you compare that to the 3-month bill yield or treasury yield in the U.S., there's a huge gap there, and that obviously has to be closed. So I think that the squeeze on the banks and the outcome on deposit is still a big unknown here. And I looked at the U.S. aggregate deposits. The latest figure we have is from March, the 8th of March, and it actually declined on a week-to-week basis here and still looking weak. I'm really curious to see those deposit numbers as they come in over the coming weeks. And on slide three, John, the overview there, we with the AT1, so the additional Tier 1 capital market in disarray yesterday morning. And then we had all these reinsurances from the European and the UK regulators that AT1 capital is still above shareholders in the capital structure, in the sense that shareholders should eat all the losses before the AT1 capital holders. And that really reassured the market, and we got the rally going. And US Bancorp, which is being rumored to, you know, be maybe headed toward a deal with Warren Buffett, was actually the best performing. And but as you said, as you noted, John, if you look at the price chart, it doesn't look really impressive. But for the day, it was up. And then we put in this new column called Total Tier 1 Capital over the total assets. So that's an implied leverage ratio. Typically, what you do in the Basel III framework is that you don't divide by the total assets, but by the total risk-weighted assets. And as I said to you, John, and Steen yesterday, the whole notion on the Basel III framework, also the held to maturity accounting rules that came after the great financial crisis, was the whole idea was that it should stabilize the system, but it only stabilizes the system if you have a stable liability side, and that's what we're going to find out now with this deposit game. But the other key,
and when you, just to point out, for it's, you know, banking language is I think quite difficult for even many experienced investors, that when you say the liability side, you sort of indicated right there that this, the deposits, that is a concern on the liability side, the funding side.
Exactly. Thank you for clarifying that, because it's a different way of looking at a balance sheet when we're talking about banks. So the reason why I put in this total tier one capital over total assets is that inside the Basel III framework as well, you have these different risk classifications on the different assets, and one of the lowest risk assets you can have are the U.S. Treasuries and European government bonds. And that's why, also because of the liquidity measures, that we require more liquidity in banks than back in 2007 and 2008. So they have loaded up on all these government bonds. But it only works if risk weighting, which a priori has been set by regulators in Basel, if they work across all risk scenarios. I would argue that there is a nonlinear effect here, that when you change the risk and the environment and you suddenly have an unstable deposit side, then those risk ratings are not equal. And when you have had an interest rate shock and you sit on very high unrealized losses in your held to maturity bonds, on those government bonds, it's not any longer the appropriate risk rate. So that's why what I've put in here is basically the lower bound on your leverage. And you can see which companies are the most extended in terms of leverage. And those are the ones in red on this table, on that column.
All right. And also just three names I think that are interesting to follow here. One is the First Republic Bank. It's the worst performer yesterday on that list. Well, Credit Suisse doesn't exist anymore, so we can knock that one off very soon. Minus 47% yesterday. So that's one of the ones that has to, of course, be addressed. It can't be allowed to fail, presumably, but we'll see what happens there. U.S. Bancorp, on the other hand, was at the very positive end of that list, at the very bottom there, best performer. I guess, some rumors or talks that Berkshire Hathaway, Warren Buffett in the mix there on that bank. And then I would just point out one interesting one that has a massive held-to-maturity portfolio, and you wonder, you know, where their deposits or their accounts could head to if they're seen as being at risk, and that'd be Charles Schwab. I don't want to speculate on banks having difficulties, but it's just an interesting name with that massive held to maturity portfolio.
Yeah, I think we should go to the currency market, right? Because it's a big FOMC week, and I think that we need to address that, John.
Yeah, I think the market is having a hard time figuring out what to do here, waiting for the FOMC and what happens. If we can hold together some sense of normalcy, the FOMC plays ball with expectations, marks the dot plot more or less. I would be surprised if they are willing to go all the way where the market is for this year. Market is at 4% for the end of FOMC, or the Fed funds rate, sorry, at the end of this year versus, of course, 5+ in the December dot plot. Is the Fed willing to go that far to meet where the market is? And then there's also that big markdown further for 2024. Fed original dot plot from December was lower for 2024, but not as low as the market is. Still about 100 basis points disparity between December and what the market is saying. I suspect if we're in this sort of state here, or have even improved slightly further, the Fed will be happy to move forward with the 25 basis point move. But then it's about the forward guidance and whether it's willing to go where the market is. So waiting for the dollar and how risk sentiment absorbs all of this, how the Fed positions what's going on, very critical. The yen, for example, still strong, as you can see on the FX board there on slide 4, but weakening quite sharply from its strongest levels midday because we had that mean reversion in interest rates. Just goes to show you that the Japanese yen can only thrive when all rates are headed lower. Starting with the interesting relative strength there, I wonder if there's some slightly more negative focus on the euro with the whole banking situation. That's a focus. And then the Swiss franc, where I think it deserves a marking lower. And I put up the Euro Swiss chart there to indicate the sort of round trip, first playing as a safe haven as yields collapsed and the focus was on SVB. And then suddenly when it came home to roost with Credit Suisse, heading back the other way, the SNB, so the Swiss National Bank, has a heck of a lot of risk online in backing up the USB or the shotgun wedding of UBS and Credit Suisse. And I think some of that line of credit is going to end up getting used. So it probably deserves to be marked a bit lower. But I think it'll be some time before the Swiss franc is not seen as a safe haven if the times really get stressed here and the situation broadens out elsewhere. Gold's still strong, Ole, but has mean reverted together with a lot of other markets. But what's your focus here in the commodity market? We're just continuing to fizzle in terms of these themes with China, a reopening story just going absolutely nowhere. But what are you looking for here?
Well, I'm just taking a different look this morning because obviously we've been focusing a lot of on the win and the loser during the past week or so. That's been gold to the upside and crude oil to the downside. But one market that has done, I would say, reasonably well is copper. While crude is down around 12% this month, copper is down 3.5%. As you can see on the chart there, we're still in a downtrend from the highs back in January. But we haven't really had any escalating, any big breakdown. And it basically is because copper and industrial metals are very China-focused, and we are seeing a recovery in China unfolding right now. It is leading to a pickup in demand. We're seeing that on inventory levels. There was a build-up in inventories on slide 5, the top right slide. Or picture there, you can see there was quite a bit of a build-up at the start of the year during the China Lunar New Year. And since then, some of that, and that basically inventories were building up in anticipation of demand coming in. That demand is starting to come to fruition, and we're seeing inventories coming down. At the same time, speculators basically spent the last 5 weeks or 4 weeks cutting their long in copper to a net short. So again, they are back to neutral, so that leaves plenty of room. Yesterday we had the FT Commodity Summit. We had some of the titans from the industry, Trafigura, Glencore, Mercuria, all looking for tight markets, looking for the electrification to gather momentum. And with that, the prospect of record high prices to be seen within the next year. So so I think it just highlights the theme that copper is actually doing reasonably well despite of the uncertainty we have in the market in general.
All right. And then on gas, my favorite market to comment on when it's getting where it is at now, Ule, which is at very, very low levels. I said maybe they ought to put a price floor on gas just to ensure that it's such a strategically important product these days, geopolitically everywhere. I can't believe it's back down at these levels, but that's just the nature of the beast when you have ongoing supplies and you just don't have the demand coming in because of weather.
Indeed. And once again, it's just simply the... Well, part of it is, as we know, in Europe has been a slowdown in demand. High prices have been killing demand. But at the same time, we all know this winter has been wild, and we're heading for unseasonal warm weather as we head towards spring, both in Northern Europe and in the US. And that's basically leaving a lot of gas in storage. And just recently, we've actually seen quite a big collapse in LNG shipments to Europe, simply because there's not availability, simply because we don't need it right now. And that's adding some downward pressure on prices, inventory levels, both in Europe. Especially in Europe, but also in the US, increasingly in recent weeks has not dropped at the pace that you would normally see this time of year. So ample of gas, plenty of availability is just adding downward pressure to the price. And if I may just finish off the commodity sector, John, as we talked about gold before, it has taken all the headlines recently. It raced higher. We reached the record high yesterday against the Aussie dollar. We reached a near record against the euro. Against the dollar, we've still got some way to go. But when we see these accelerations in gold, quite often some of the other metals that to a certain extent also tracks the gold price is left behind. And that basically means something like platinum has once again reached the discount to gold of around $1,000. We saw that happen also around this time last year. And in the following months, platinum outperformed by $300. What we're seeing and what we're hearing from the Platinum Investment Council which is like the World Gold Council for platinum, they are seeing the risk of an emerging deficit this year. And what has been missing has been investment demand. And we are actually seeing a small pickup in ETF holdings in recent weeks. And if that continues with the general appetite for metals, then this market could fairly quickly switch into a deficit market, and that will add some additional support. So with that in mind, I find the $1,000 discount as relatively cheap for platinum.
All right. And if we look forward at stocks to watch today, in the next slide there, Peter, on slide 8, we've had a little bit of talk about that RWE this morning, and then Amazon laying off more people.
Yes, so Amazon is doing another layoff. They already did 18,000 and now they do 9,000. And it's mostly in their corporate parts of the business, not in the fulfillment centers. And Amazon has been overinvesting during the pandemic. I think we have written at that a couple of times in some of our equity notes during the pandemic. And now they're feeling the fallout from that. I think potentially it's a turning point for their profitability when you lay off so many people. So from a shareholder perspective, it will be greeted positively, I think, in the session. I also think that Amazon, though, if you look at the slide 8 and you look at the price chart there, I mean, it's only slightly up over a 5-year horizon. I think we're getting closer to a point where suddenly you could see some of the big activist investors in the US circle around this company and pushing for a change. And I think that change would be a divestment of their Amazon Web Services, which is their cloud business. It's the market leader in that industry. I think the value they could extract from listing this company as a separate company would be quite extraordinary. So I think we're getting closer and closer to this point. And then, John, as you correctly said, the RWE, they one of the biggest utility companies here in Europe, they are putting out an outlook that is above the current estimates from analysts, as you can see here in the text. And it's driven by very strong expectations they have for their solar and wind businesses. Although they're complaining a little bit about that, you know, the rollout of solar, especially the solar panels, is slowing down because of US bans. So that's something to keep in mind there. And then staying with the Chinese theme, Anta Sports, which is the equivalent of Nike, shares up 9%. Very strong results for 2022. And that's despite a Chinese economy that has been essentially in a lockdown. They're also raising their dividends. And I think it's a pretty good temperature on the consumer sector. And as I've said before, that's also why we have the Chinese consumer and technology basket, is that there's a lot of regulation around technology. And we'll talk more about that when we get the Tencent's recent result during this week. It's really causing a lot of headwinds for Chinese technology companies. So the consumer stocks they don't have the same sensitive issues as data privacy, etc. So it's really a part of the Chinese equity market to look out for if you want a more pure exposure to China. And then Anta Sports, very good setup, I think, for tonight's results from Nike, which is expected to see revenue growth of 6%. It's still the market leader, phenomenal company. I'm really curious. They will be reporting for the quarter that ended in February, so it's very timely figures we get, only 3 weeks old, and I'm really curious to see their outlook for the global consumer, especially maybe comments around what are they seeing on the ground in China. Is there a pickup in consumer sentiment and spending in China, because this reopening trade, John, it doesn't really feel very powerful at this point, but maybe Nike is seeing something different.
All right, let's go to the macro calendar. And also we have Xi still in Moscow, Putin saying he will listen to Xi Jinping's plans for peace or ideas for peace proposals. Of course, these will be a non-starter with Ukraine and with Ukraine supporters if these freeze the current lines of the conflict. And then Russia's territorial claims within Ukraine's territory, etc. But I think the interesting positioning here is whether something new could come about in that discussion, and as well that supposedly Xi Jinping will be talking with Ukrainian President Zelensky. What comes out of that? The U.S. criticizing everything China's doing as providing diplomatic cover, quote-unquote, of Putin, Russia's Putin, just after the ICC declared him essentially a war criminal and put out a warrant for his arrest. So it's an interesting situation that we need to continue to track if anything can shift the odds of what's going on there and what has been mired into a sort of unmoving conflict. Back to the economic data, though, we have the German ZEW out this morning. It's had a massive improvement in the expectations component after that reached essentially the lowest levels ever, or nearly the lowest levels ever, matching 2008 more or less. Of course, the improvement on the fact the worst fears were not realized, so that expectations function went way higher, back to even above the mid-range of the last many years. some mean reversion expected. Expect that expected to fall. I think most interesting will be the Eurozone March flash PMIs and whether we're seeing some cooling off in the next couple of months as we sort of weathered the winter's time frame better than expected. And we also have the Q1 Westpac consumer confidence out of New Zealand after their Q4 figure was the lowest ever in that survey, which stretches all the way back to 1988. But it is all about the FOMC tomorrow. These other things are mere distractions and subplots. There's also a U.S. 20-year auction today. May or may not be interesting for what rates are doing. Watch for that. And yeah, we'll have more thoughts on the FOMC tomorrow with the next Saxo Market Call.
Thanks for listening. This has been the Saxo Market Call. For feedback and questions, reach out to us on Twitter at Saxo Market Call or by email, marketcall@saxobank.com.